their secret mountain lair somewhere in Colorado. This is the Image Doctors Photography Podcast with your hosts, Jason Odell and Rick Walker.
Hey, I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And welcome to the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. How you doing, Rick?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Just watching the COVID stuff go up and down, and mostly up lately.
Yeah, it looks like
not looking like a fun winter.
No, it's a little bit tricky. Hopefully our listeners are still staying safe out there. It's a little bit weird watching all this stuff go sideways right now. But we have an interesting program lined up for you. Well, at least we think it's interesting lined up for today. We're going to mostly be talking about, there's been a lot of software update in the last week across the board. So we'll be talking about some new updates from Adobe, DxO, some other things, and what's new
in Capture One,
and Photoshop, some things that are new there. We'll talk about that, and we'll spend a little time on some of those features and why you might use them a little later on. So, and we also want to, we're going to follow up a little bit on some commentary regarding our Z6 and 7 Mark II review last week. There's just been some crazy stuff out there on the internet. We thought we'd weigh in with our opinion on that. But before we get to that, let's just mention what's all been either announced this week or is due to be announced, starting with there was a huge update in the Adobe Creative Cloud space. So for those people with the Adobe subscription, whether it's just the photography piece with Lightroom and Photoshop or more, there was a ton of updates that came down this week, including significant release update to Lightroom and Photoshop. So Photoshop is now 2021, whatever version that is. I don't remember what the numerical version. Yeah. And Lightroom is now Lightroom Classic, as well as Lightroom Non-Classic, were both updated to new major increment versions. So Lightroom is now version 10. So it's been a while. For those people who are still using older versions of Lightroom, you're not, you know, the last boxed version of Lightroom was what, 6?
Yeah.
And so you're now four versions behind if you don't have the subscription version, which is, you know, your personal choice, but there are a lot of features that have been added in the last 5 or 6 years. So,
including things that we probably use every single day, like range masking.
Right.
Wonderful
feature. Slider.
Yeah.
Those things.
They're a bunch.
Yeah. Exactly. So Lightroom was announced, and as well as Photoshop. So let's quickly talk about what's new there. Lightroom really only got one, well, most of it is performance improvements, bug fixes, things under the hood. There's a new version of Camera Raw has come out, so it's going to have camera and lens combination, so that's always good, because newer cameras, newer lenses are now going to be supported. But the biggest change from a user standpoint, I think, in Lightroom is the replacement of the split toning panel with a panel called color grading.
Right.
And so help our listeners understand what that really is, Rick, because it's not something we use a lot, but we'll talk about it later.
Occasionally. And we are going to talk in detail about how you can use it and stuff. But basically, it's a feature that goes one step above the former split toning feature, where you could you could think of it as the color temperature, how warm, how cool either the shadow area was or the highlight area.
So or even just two
ranges you could play with. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, exactly. This is where you did sepia toning, right? So stuff like that, or cyanotype or whatever. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, okay. And so with this feature, it's one up from that, and that you can now handle both of those areas as well as the mid-tones separately. And that's the main advantage with it. It's it's very, very similar to a feature that Capture One has had for a little while. I mean, it's almost a twin in every respect. So I've had some insights into the tool from playing with that, and we can talk about that later.
Yeah. So you're taking something that used to just have, you know, highlight tinting and shadow tinting, and you could blend them. Mm-hmm. Now you've separated this out into really four components, because you've got highlights, midtones, and shadows, but there's also a master, you could do a master tint overlay if you mm-hmm. wanted to mm-hmm. on sure. the whole image. So we'll talk about why you might want to do that.
We'll save that.
And then over on the, as long
we'll blow through the whole podcast.
Right. Over on the, and staying with the Adobe side, Photoshop was updated as well. So anyone who's getting the subscription, you know, you get both pieces. And there's been, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of things, but as far as what struck me, they've added a dedicated sky replacement, automated sky replacement that includes mm-hmm. A bunch of different sky images. So that follows in this trend that we've seen from other companies. We talked about Luminar mm-hmm. having sky replacement that works really well. And so Photoshop now has a dedicated tool, and it's under the edit menu, and you go edit, and then there's sky replacement. You get a dialog box, and it seems to work pretty well. I mean, I just played with it to see. It does some automatic masking and it lets you play with lighting a little bit. So it's a little bit, mm-hmm. it's a little bit interesting, and it does stuff and it applies the effect in layers, so you can undo it easily enough if you don't like it. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think right now neither of us has had enough time with it to be able to say how it really compares in terms of smartness with the one that's in Luminar. And then, of course, Luminar's getting improvements shortly that should be really nice, like handling sky reflections. You know.
Yes, I've seen some stuff suggesting that they're refining theirs in the mm-hmm. pending release. I mean, you know, and we've talked about this in the past, neither of us really do sky replacement because it's just not the thing. But if you're doing digital artwork based on photography, where you know, or you're doing marketing things where you need to have this, or mm-hmm. You know, real estate photography potentially, where you want a nicer sky, but you know, you had no choice but to shoot it on a blah day or an overcast day. You know, this is a good thing. Not what we incorporate into our landscape nature photography stuff, but you know, it's mm-hmm. That doesn't make it invalid. It just means that it's not something that you or I do.
No, and I'll just mention one thing quickly, and maybe we said this when we were talking about the Luminar thing. One of the things that you can do that I feel less bad about, I guess, less guilty, is, you know, sometimes you can be out shooting at a location, and just because of the wind patterns and everything, the sky can change quickly. Mm-hmm. So you can go from a situation where your sky is doing everything that you want. You've got the clouds in the right place and life is wonderful, and then they move out of the way quickly, and it turns out that that's at a point where the light is really good on the landscape. And, you know, so you can certainly, using the Photoshop thing, get shots of the sky that day that you like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe just shots only of the sky, and then paste those in to a shot, making it look like it would have just a few minutes earlier or later or whatever. And that doesn't seem quite as bad to me for whatever reason. It's
right. It's not like you're making a sky out of whole cloth or whole pixels.
No, it's more like saying this is kind of the way it looked at one of the right. times while I was out shooting. I just wasn't able to get things to line up perfectly. And
temporal displacement.
Yeah, so that's a potential rationalization I might use at some point
there,
in the future.
There you go. Couple other quick things in Photoshop. They mm-hmm. come out with this thing called neural filters, which is under the filter menu, mm-hmm. And it's used for portrait retouching. So it does some automated, you know, skin smoothing, but it also mm-hmm. has these de-aging algorithms, and mm-hmm. it has the ability where you can turn the head and the pose a little bit and work things there.
Crazy stuff.
And some of it is in beta still. There's a bunch of filters that are in there that are in beta that'll allow you to do things like swap makeup from one image, you know, say you had a photograph of a model with a certain makeup pattern, and then you mm-hmm. wanted to apply that makeup to your photo, to your model, because you didn't have a makeup artist mm-hmm. there, you could theoretically do that. I have not tried that. That is way outside of my wheelhouse, but it's interesting. But maybe more interesting, because those things can get really scary really quickly. Mm-hmm. In Photoshop, in their automated selecting and masking tool, they've now improved it to add a refine hair command. So anyone who's tried to make a selection of a person, you do a headshot, and you know, especially with women where there's hair and there's, you know, wisps going up, you know, not 80s hair, but you know, just
I just had a sudden visual of that.
Well, see, neither you or I have this problem with having too much hair.
No, we do not.
So
it's such a blessing.
But hair can be a real pain in the butt to mask out. So they've now added in a button underneath the select and mask tool when you go into that mode where you can click refine hair. And it just automatically looks for hair in your image and tries to refine the mask to blend that hair in. Anyone who's tried that knows it can be a real challenge. So that's always just a good feature. Again, not something that you or I do a lot of, but it's something we have done. Both of us have done sort of headshots, whether it's family, you know, or whatever. So, so it can be a good thing.
And one thing I'll just say quickly, listeners should expect an episode from us relatively soon on portrait retouching.
Right.
That'll include some basic things that you can do with almost any program and probably a little bit about the Photoshop thing, as well as there's a new On1 photo retouching module that's out that's quite good. I've played with it for a while and it's very good, and we'll talk more about that in that episode. Right.
It will be retouching for dummies, because when it comes to retouching, yes, we are pretty much dummies on that.
But we can both get through it fine.
Oh,
we
yeah.
We tend to do the more tasteful retouches.
We're not doing Hollywood retouching, but it is good. Okay.
We know what we need to know.
So you mentioned that there's a new DxO coming out.
Yep.
Okay, it's so out. That's out. Okay.
And the main thing there is AI-based sharpening and noise reduction, which is you know, one of those big things this year. And I have not used it yet. I'll probably do that later today to see how it works. But I would imagine it works well.
Yeah. And then what else is coming out?
Capture One announced a big version upgrade. It is not out yet.
Okay.
I'll just say I have used it, so I know what's in it. And it's a nice evolutionary step. All of these things, in my mind, that we've just talked about are evolutionary changes. Mm-hmm. They're not really revolutionary, but they're nice. They're all nice evolutions.
Yeah, no one's complaining that we got these things added in. I mean, we all have our wish lists of stuff that we'd like to see, but these are all solid things. So if you're using any of these programs, be on the lookout for the updates. One thing in Lightroom is that you will have to update your catalog when the first time you launch the old catalog. Doing so preserves your old catalog, you know, creates a new file. It does now give you the option of naming it something different if you want to. Instead of just adding a number on the back. So that's kind of nice. Just be aware that if you ever had to downgrade your light, you'd still have your old catalog that would work, at least for the stuff that was in it at the time. So last week, we had our little review of the Nikon
Z7 II and Z6 II.
And you know, and so it's been a week now since those have come out. And I'll tell you what, I've seen some really kind of insane review, like not reviews, but just so like, let's be clear, no one's really reviewed this camera yet because nobody has it. I mean, very few people have even touched it. And even if you have, it was a pre-production model most likely. And so you weren't really able to make statements whatsoever, but I've seen some pretty outlandish reviews. Online, you know, just really strongly worded stuff that it just blows my mind that reviewers would go down that path.
Well, we talked about this briefly when we restarted our podcast, and one of the things that we told people is we're not going to engage in some of the practices that we see going on with reviewers on the internet. It's not all of them by any means. There's some very good ones out there who are very responsible. But we are in an era, and it's not just photography, where there are so many people out there doing psychological manipulation of people. And you can argue that it always went on, like with advertising and some other things, but it is much more prevalent and it's much uglier. And there's a lot of people doing things to exaggerate things. You know, when you see YouTube things or internet articles or whatever that start with fail in capital letters with an exclamation mark, that tells you something about the people doing it. And it what it should tell you is you are being manipulated by them in order to get clicks and money and stuff like that.
Right.
So, you know, we've used an awful lot of this stuff that's out there. Name a brand, between the two of us, we've used it, and we've used a sizable percentage of the more popular cameras and stuff that are out there. At this point, they are all damn good. And the reason reviewers are doing some of that crap, and I use the word intentionally, it's not an accident, is they know that an honest review that said, you know, these are all pretty good, maybe lean toward what you've been using, you'll save money because you won't have to sell everything off. That doesn't make for an exciting review. Instead, everything gets overanalyzed, drama put on it, things that are not even significant factors suddenly become the whole highlight of it. And there's almost no realism. So be careful, be careful.
And
don't let yourself get upset by this stuff.
There's this echo chamber of confirmation bias. You want to know that you have the best thing, that your system was best. But, you know, so there's that element going on. There's clickbait stuff going on. You know, think, you know, in the old days, you had to go to the grocery store checkout aisle and you know, discreetly pick up the National Enquirer or whatever to see Batchild found in Kate. I love Batchild, but I mean,
it was a classic.
It was. And so I have my reasons, but but you know, now it's just there in the privacy of your home and you can get this confirmation bias. But let me tell you something. Between the two of us, I think we would both agree. Like you said, we've used a lot of these systems. Not all of them. I've certainly used fewer than you have. But I mean, you've used I think if there's one that we've used the least, it's been Canon. But even then, you know,
I've used enough.
You've used Sony. You've used Olympus. We've used the Fuji. We've used we've used those Panasonics. You know, other things. I don't think we've ever come across a camera or a system where the conclusion of our review would be sell all your gear from brand A and switch to brand B.
No.
That is never a conclusion that we would make. You can point out there may be some advantages here or there, you know, and again, that depends on what you shoot, what your subjects are. But to go out and suggest that you should, you know, in the context of last week, sell all your Nikon lenses because clearly, you know, the future is somebody else. That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And it makes you wonder where those quote reviewers are getting their paycheck from, you know, to be fair.
It's what we talked about earlier.
Right. I mean, it just makes
you thrive on change and churn and people hitting the buy button from their website.
That's exactly right. And it's crazy. I mean, we've mentioned that there's some really cool features, like we talked about some of the newer Canon mirrorless is coming out. They have some really amazing features. And so those are good things. But, you know, I'm going to go back to our review and we'll end it. But to sort of summarize what we said last week that might have gotten lost in the translation, there are things, and Nikon has said this, there are things that you can do with the existing hardware, and there are things that you can't. When you buy a new iPhone or any smartphone, for example, you're upgrading. It's evolutionary at this point. Why do you do it? Most of your features have come through in the software and the operating system, right? But you know what? If you want the phone that can do the portrait mode, which is like the software algorithms, it has to have the right kind of camera and the right kind of hardware and enough processing power to deal with that. So I, you know, we were talking the other day, we never really had any major grievance with the form factor, the sensors, the anything in the in the Nikon mirrorless. You know, we like them. They added a second processor into these. That is the improvement, a second processor. And it doesn't sound like much at all today, but you brought up a good point last time, Rick, which was it's going to enable their developers to write newer firmware algorithms and get features that don't exist today, but they'll only be able to be run on those newer cameras with the faster horsepower.
Right.
So
right.
A year from now or 6 months from now, people might be going, oh my gosh, you know, look, they came out with some crazy new eye detection, you know, whatever, who knows, right? I mean, some feature that doesn't exist today. So that's all I wanted to say about that, but it was just, I was blown away by some of the, it's not even the negativity. I mean, yeah, you want a new shiny object, but to really do a disservice to your listeners to say, you know, this is, you know, I unbelievable stuff out there. So
yeah, it's, and I'll just say one more thing and then we'll get on with something.
We'll end the op-ed productive show. Yeah, I mean,
I guess I'm going to say two things. One, if you find yourself getting unhappy when there are product announcements and you find yourself going online and posting nasty comments about something, really think twice. Really think twice about how it's upsetting you. You should be getting joy from all of this, not pain and suffering. And I absolutely see people experiencing that. It's like, please don't. It's not useful. And then, like we were saying before, I'm not talking from a position of ignorance when I talk about this stuff. In addition to using the Z6 and 7, I have used the Sony A7 R4. I have used the Canon R5. I've used other ones out there. They are all damn good. And personally, if one of them went away and I had to use one of the others, I'd be happy as a clam. There are not big differences. And if you have any experience at all, you can pick up another one and start shooting very quickly. They're all pretty damn similar.
Yeah.
There are not huge differences. Anyway, end of my spiel.
Yeah, this concludes the op-ed portion of our program. Let's but it's true. I mean, it's something that you know, people just get too engrossed in every tech and oh dang, they didn't come out with some, you know, new 70 megapixel super thing, so we must suck, you know, like no. Yeah. So anyway, let's finish off by just looping back.
Let's do something positive.
Yeah, let's.
And in the spirit of being nonpartisan, we'll just simply say that what we talk about here in Lightroom applies really well to Capture One. Every single thing we say. So there you can pick which one you like. I've used both. I own both. They're both great.
So Lightroom added this new, they got rid of the panel that was called toning or split toning. I forget what it was called.
Yeah.
Split toning. I've replaced it with one that's now called color grading. And as we mentioned, it now allows you to change, overlay a color, a hue, a color, and a saturation amount to three tone ranges, including the plus the master image. Lets you do a few other things too. You can actually adjust the luminance, the brightness of those ranges too. So that's kind of a cool little byproduct of this. Why would you want to mess with colors in those tone ranges? You know, philosophically and creatively, what is it that we accomplish by having this tool? Because it's not something that you or I use a lot.
No. I'll start off with something that is a bit more boring, but still potentially useful for certain images. One of the things that was considered attractive in the past for landscape photographers, which we both do a lot with Velvia, was that compared to other slide films, it had more of a tendency to go blue in the shadows and then warm in the highlights. And that was kind of a nice look at times. You know, it's sort of what you expect to see in a lot of respects. And it would, you know, there's a nice thing that comes out of color theory about when you put certain color combinations together, you know, blues and reds are a good one. And, you know, just where there are opposite ends of the
blue and yellow, red and green, yeah. Those complementary mm-hmm. colors. Yeah,
exactly. And so you can, you know, what Velvia did was kind of accentuate that. But you can do the same thing with this. And you could do it with split toning too. And occasionally I did where I would just pop in just a tiny amount of blue into the shadows and just a little bit of warmth in the highlights. You had to be careful because you could overdo it quickly. But it could be a nice look for certain images. And certainly you can do that with the new tool as well, and then keep the midtones, you know, fairly clean. Mm-hmm. So that's a nice simple thing.
And that you would just use on a regular color image, and you're just mm-hmm. tweaking the appearance. And I tried it actually. I had a landscape and it was like a little hazy day. And so mm-hmm. I just added a little blue tint to the highlights, and it worked. It made my sky a little bluer because that's where the highlights happened to be in mm-hmm. that photo. That was the bright area. There are other ways, of course, to accomplish that. You know, you could do range masking and you know,
right.
and this, but this is an easy way. If you wanted to tint apply a color tint to a tone range, highlights, midtones, shadows, this is the tool to do it. But then, of course, there is the simplest thing, right, which is goes back. It does replace the split toning module because mm-hmm. this is where you would apply split toning. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to do a sepia tone or a cyanotype or any kind of split tone where you've got, mm-hmm. you know, from the traditional sepia look to a more artistic, you know, duotone look. This is where you could make that happen.
And so the same idea that I was mentioning for a color image can be done for a black and white mm-hmm. image too, where you have the darker tones go just slightly bluish, and then the brightest part goes slightly warmish. And if used tastefully, that can be a nice look for mm-hmm. a print like that too. And certainly you can do the same thing with this and have a little bit more control. And again, this all applies to the Capture One stuff as well. The other thing though it does, and this, like you were saying, isn't something that we do a lot with, I play with it on occasion, is, you know, going for that more cinematic sort of view where you're doing larger scale color and tonal manipulation. It's very popular for wedding photographers, people doing environmental portraits. You see
that
it a lot
look.
In travel shots. Well, it's sort of a film-like look, but it's a film that you never shot probably.
Right.
But it can be interesting, you know, and you know, I did a little bit for some of my shots from Vietnam, just because in some cases I just didn't have that interesting of light. And so I just said, well, maybe I'll try this. And it is interesting for certain things. But you can create a whole bunch of different looks on your own and create presets for them. And so if you're someone that does event kind of stuff, you can create a look that you like and then quickly copy it across, you know, a whole bunch of images. And that can have some power if you're trying to get a consistent look, which typically you do want to do if you're shooting for a client. You don't want to have a bunch of radically different looks. You know, having some cohesiveness and consistency across the images is a good thing.
But yeah, in some ways, this kind of is reminiscent of the color lookup tables, the LUTs that we talked about
much.
Using some of when we talked about profiles a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. A couple episodes ago, those creative profiles that are in Lightroom, does the same thing. You think, you know, you want to think of an extreme cinematic look. I was just thinking, think Game of Thrones, you know, that bluish, you know, where everything looks like it's winter, even though it was filmed in daylight. and it was filmed in early morning. I know because my sister, who's probably listening, has been an extra on Game of Thrones in the past, so knows what it's like. And you know, mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they weren't all blue.
And but you
if
see
Jessica
it in,
wants
in...
to weigh in on this on the Facebook page, I'll let her do that. But yeah. You can get those kinds of looks, and so really, what this tool is, it's a more refined version of this because now you have control in three different tone ranges as well as brightness, things that just didn't exist in the old split toning tool. And one of the cool things I've noticed because I just played with it quickly is that Lightroom includes split toning presets in the, mm-hmm. you know, like sepia, and they've adapted those now to the new tool. And one of the things that's cool about a lot of these programs is that most of these presets, in fact, I would say all, even, you know, I know a lot of people make money selling presets, but most of the time these presets are all things that are visible adjustments in the existing controls that you can look at. If I click a preset in Lightroom, I can look in the develop module and just see what it did. I can see, okay, it used this adjustments in this panel and these sliders, and this is what it's doing. And you can kind of deconstruct that if you're willing to look. And that can be a useful learning tool. And that goes without saying.
Yeah, unfortunately, the path that a lot of these go down don't allow you to see that anymore. So you don't see sliders moved or anything like mm-hmm. that anymore with the newer approaches, which makes editing cleaner. But there's less of a learning experience with it, unfortunately.
It becomes harder
but
to adjust.
I think you're saying it, you can do some nice things with moods.
Yes. You
know, and
so you know, cool colors just, make it like a exactly. you know like a more somber mood or a cool, you know, blues make things look cold. You can have yellows and oranges make things look warmer depending on your light.
And yeah.
Right. So it's all fun stuff. I mean, it's like there are, and we'll talk
I'm sure we'll see a rash of people putting out new Lightroom presets based on this function.
Oh,
I'm sure it'll show up tomorrow.
I'm sure.
If but, they you know, haven't one, already.
One thing, I guess, in the take-home message of this whole thing, as we're running out of time, is that, you know, color can have a very strong impact on mood, and it doesn't have to be crazy, you know, strong adjustments. Subtle adjustments to colors can really influence the mood in a photo. You know, small movements, you know, making things more bluish, more orange, you know, warmer, cooler, or anything in between. And we'll probably talk about some fundamentals of color theory in another episode, but it's one of those things that just, again, it allows you to refine things if you're willing to, you know, if you're serious about stuff and you want to get a certain kind of feel from an image, it's tools that you wouldn't get in your camera, right? I mean, it's
right.
something that's not going to be there. Like you mentioned Velvy, I mean, you had to have that kind of film to get that particular look. We're blessed to live in a time where now you can get anything out of your camera and have it then take the best parts of the films that you used back in the day, if you used film, and get those same moods and those same feelings.
Mm-hmm. But I think especially people like wedding photographers, portrait photographers should take a look at it, play with it,
definitely.
Try creating your own looks, your own presets, as opposed to someone else's. And, you know, a very useful thing to do after you think you've got it dialed in, make sure you do a little bit of before and after. Is it really improving the photo? Or did you do the boiling frog thing where you incrementally got to a point where it's just hideous? It's very useful to do that before after thing. And then maybe get someone else to take a look at it too before you really pull the trigger on it with clients and stuff. That's what I would say. But there's power in it.
Yeah, always a good idea. Well, we look forward to hearing from our listeners. You guys out there are the reason why we do this. I mean, we like talking with each other, but feedback from our listeners brings us a little bit of joy, especially these days where we're not going out and doing as much shooting as we would prefer. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/imagedoctors. Leave your show comments, suggestions, topic suggestions, whatever you got, questions for us. We're here to answer them. And so until next time, we wish you happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.